You know you have the right product line if you get an immediate response within 3 hours of an email.
Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters. I'm your host, Serena Smith, and this is your companion for starting and scaling a business. This founder sent one cold email to a Whole Foods buyer and got a response in 3 hours. Not 3 days, not 3 weeks, 3 hours.
You are setting yourself up for more success the more you put yourself in the field. If you're not visible, you can't be bought.
Michelle Razavi and Nikki Elliott didn't doubt themselves when they hit send. That email launched her protein dessert company, Alavi, into over 50 Whole Foods stores.
There's a difference between good and great. A good business does okay. An exceptional business, they go above and beyond.
Today, we'll get right into her pitching strategy, what to do after you get a response, and how you can set yourself up to launch in a nationwide retailer. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
Oh my God, stoked to have you. As legend has it, and as I just set up in the intro, you sent one email that landed you in Whole Foods. How does something like this happen?
It all happened very quickly. That when I say it out loud, it also sounds crazy. But yeah, so I took it upon myself because I'm a huge advocate of closed mouths, don't get fed. And if you don't advocate for yourself, who will? So I found the email for the global Whole Foods buyer and, not expecting anything, crafted a pitch email pitching ourselves, this new protein brownie that we literally just launched a month into market, but I knew it was so innovative, I had to put it in front of him. And within a couple hours, he immediately got back to me. It was like, can I try samples? This looks exactly what we're looking for. And the rest is history.
To say that that's a rarity is such a vast understatement. To get a response at all, first of all, let alone after a few hours, what do you think it was?
I think it's a combination of two things. One is crafting the perfect pitch. And I'm not saying that all my pitches are always perfect and I 100% get all the shots I make, but I think something resonated, the timing was right. And then the second piece is, do you have the right product or opportunity or service or whatever you're pitching? And so both of those intersected perfectly. And from a pitch standpoint, what really worked was what I like to call the three C's, which is craft a concise pitch, make it compelling, and have a clear call to action at the end. And my pitch emails, I make sure to hit all three of those things. And so when I talk about making it concise, it's, I like to use the analogy of the perfect length of a skirt for a woman, right? Short enough to keep it interesting, but long enough to cover the good parts. And I want to make sure that, you know, when I'm pitching a retailer or a buyer or investor or whoever, you know, that I'm immediately capturing their attention with a hook, getting to the point right away, keeping it compelling so that, you know, there's something of interest for them. And really, how do you make the offer, the ask, the whatever, more focused on what value you can provide them versus them helping you out? And I think that's the psychology that a lot of business owners, especially earlier stage, they want to just word vomit their whole story and they send an essay. And it's really thinking about who's reading it on the other side. And so by keeping it concise, by making it all about what you're going to provide them, that shifts the energy of the email and really perks them up because it stands out. And then lastly, have a call to action, the so what. Can I send you samples? Let me know the best address to send you samples, or let me know if I can XYZ, and make it clear that there's something on the other side for them. That invites them to obviously respond, right? You don't want to just vomit everything onto them and then just leave them with that essay that you just wrote them. And so I think the combination of really thinking about the mechanics and the strategy of the art and the science of that cold pitch. And then we had a very innovative product. It's the first to market protein brownie that's vegan, gluten-free, no added sugars, sweetened with dates at a time when every protein snack uses sugar alcohols or stevia or just random things that you can't pronounce. And it was coming from a lens of creating protein snacks for women. And when you look at our backgrounds, my co-founder and I have corporate backgrounds, but we also are fitness trainers and we have been for over a decade. And that authority in the wellness space really stands out and provides that layer of legitimacy that most snack brands in our category don't have. And the fact that we're women too, creating a product to help women get more protein, get more fiber, cut their sugar intake with a lens of helping women in their health journeys, that really stood out to our buyer too of, oh, wow, I know the stats that 80% of women make purchasing decisions for their households. And there aren't that many products, especially protein products, that are really marketed and designed for them. And we really bridge that gap. And I think our buyers, especially a Whole Foods buyer, is really in tune with the market and where it's going to be. And they saw that potential and they immediately jumped at it.
You had been pitching local Whole Foods buyers in vain. Mm-hmm. And then you decided, forget this, let's go to the big dogs. Did you recalibrate your pitch at all? Or was it the same thing essentially that went out?
It was a little bit different in terms of I got straight to the point. And I think that's the key thing is it's always great to introduce yourself. It's always great to add a little bit more context about who you are and to show that there's a heart and a soul behind it. But when you think about the inboxes of these buyers, they are inundated and they have 2 seconds. And that's with a consumer too on a retail shelf. People have 2 seconds. People have a short attention span. How do you hook them immediately? So with subject lines, with the first sentence, I'm so conscious of that short time that you have. And so I just made it even more impactful, even more concise. And I think it was also the right timing too, right? Can you send it at the right time when they'll most likely be at their inbox, not slam between meetings? So I wouldn't send it on a Monday and I wouldn't send it on a Friday. I would try to find that sweet spot Tuesday through Thursday. I think it's just also every particular buyer is different and they each have their own needs. They have their own, you know, insights, and the global buyer happened to resonate with their product more and immediately fast-tracked us through.
Are you going so far as to like doing some digging on the buyers themselves, like trying to get into their psychology when you're crafting these pitches?
If possible, yeah. Anything that I can find, I won't hold back. If I can just understand what time zone they're in even, so I know when is the best time. Or, you know, if they happen to have an active social media profile that's public, I'll for sure find it. But for the most part, buyers intentionally try to hide a lot of stuff so that you can't look them up. And so at that point, I always say, why don't you build up your profile, build up your brand authority? And that's what I think also is a part of the picture when you're thinking about pitching is whoever you're pitching, they will go research you. They're going to Google you. They're going to look at your social media. They're going to look at anything they could find online. And so how do you build that strong online profile so that when they do stalk you, you have something so glowing, they're like, I want that.
Yeah, you're bringing up something really interesting, which is like, there's something to be said. I can understand the inclination to want to put everything into the pitch. Oh my God, let me give you the full soup to nuts story, right? But then their eyes are going to gloss
over. Let me tell you about my childhood. Let me tell you about my grandma. And this is her recipe.
Right. The original genesis of the idea was when I was 4 years old.
Exactly.
They're not going to read that, right? And I think there's something really wise that you're saying here about understanding that if their interest is piqued, then they will go and they will do their own research outside of it. And understanding that like the narrative will come through if you've done the work to be doing the storytelling on social and in other places, and hopefully you've gotten some good press and whatever. You guys have a really beautiful and unique approach to social in that you're very warts and all, you know? Talk to me about how you developed that and why you decided to share so much of yourselves.
Yeah, it happened bit by bit. You know, I'm a hardcore millennial who, you know, grew up in the Instagram, Pinterest era. And so when I first started my foray into social media, everything had to be polished and perfectly curated and edited. And around 2020, you start to see the emergence of TikTok. And that really changed everything for me, for everyone. And you start to see, you know, more of this unfiltered, raw, vulnerable, off-the-cuff type of content. And that, for me, was a breath of fresh air because I would spend so much time obsessing over the editing, the lighting, making sure my face looked perfect. And I don't have the time for that. Most entrepreneurs don't. And so this new style of just off-the-cuff format was so easy to churn out content faster. It allowed me to have permission to share our story in a more authentic way, raw way. And the numbers were stronger. People resonated more with a more casual, random video versus some very polished, perfect professional photography. And once I started being very data-driven, I'm like, what just works? What moves the needle? It just made so much sense for us. And so I just started getting more empowered by the numbers of seeing the traction and the resonance and the comments and the messages and the conversations we're having and creating online. And that's how we were able to develop a content strategy that is more organic, that's more authentic, and it allows us to storytell behind the scenes. And we learned, oh, people really like that. People resonate with that. And it's not as scary as you think once you do it a couple times. Mm-hmm. And
it's, you got to just jump off the cliff.
100%. And once you do it, then you're like, I survived. I'm alive. And more people end up reaching out to you saying, hey, I really connected with that.
That's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like on a personal level.
Yeah. And it just like, it validates you that especially entrepreneurship is such a lonely journey. And I'm fortunate to have a co-founder, but still, it's so hard what you're going through and you don't even have the words half the time to express how you're feeling. And everything moves so crazy fast that your brain can't even process it all. Mm-hmm. And so to have an outlet like social media where you can share even a small glimmer of what's going on behind the scenes humanizes the brand and allows people to come be a part of something and really just build publicly. And I think that's the new age of building a consumer brand is building in public. And I think, yeah, people are just ready for that.
There's like a mindset shift that it requires around the notion of like, if you're building a business, there's this maybe wrong and antiquated expectation that everything should look intensely professional. Mm-hmm. And that if you show the flaws of what's mm-hmm. going on behind the scenes, it's going to make you look like a less valuable or less trustworthy company. But it sounds like you're saying that almost the opposite is true.
Yeah.
That the more you let people in, the more it allows you to build loyalty and community.
And I want to break down that fear. It's very common for women, too, to feel like we have to be perfect, to feel like we always have to be presentable. And that's cultural, structural, you know, implications that we just grew up with. Mm-hmm. And a way to challenge that, I feel, is to show up imperfect, to show up and show the messiness and the vulnerability. And I was so afraid that my investors would judge me because they follow me on social media. But seeing messages of them saying, I love following you on social media. It's so fun. I feel like I'm part of the action. And for the most part, people understand that nothing's going to be perfect. Their lives aren't perfect, so why should someone online be? And I personally don't like following people who have this perfect, curated life. I find it annoying and just unattainable. And I'm like, I can't relate to this. And so when I think about what kind of content would I like to see, I use that as my North Star of something that's empowering, uplifting, but also shows really the messiness that is life.
One of my favorite posts of yours is like, it was like the four stages of being a female founder.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Can you take us through? Because it was so good and like kind of savage, frankly, which I loved.
Yeah. I mean, so the four stages of being a female founder or just being a early stage business is that, you know, you first start to tell people and people are like, oh, don't call yourself an entrepreneur. Don't even say that. You know, there's just this like dismissiveness and shutdown of how dare you even say something like that. And it's coming from a good place, I think, when people are trying to say, hey, don't say that or don't be too big or don't take up too much space because I think they want to protect you mm-hmm. from the hardship, the rejection, the insane just intensity of running a business. And then the next stage is when people are like, oh, cool. It looks like you're picking up. Like, is this like Avon? Is this like, you know, a cute little side project you got going on? And again, I don't think that people want to intentionally put entrepreneurs down. I think it's they just don't understand that this is an idea. This is way more than a project. This is a business you're building. This is your livelihood. But yeah, you do get put down a little bit and people diminish your hard work and call it a cute little side project or, you know, they make comments. And then as you start to pick up traction, people are like, wow, look at you go. Like, can I get some free product? Can I?
All of a sudden they're fans.
Like, you know, this is amazing. Like, look at you go. And you're like, yeah, I've been working really hard at this. And then lastly, it's like, wow, like so cool to see you successful. I've cheered you on the whole time. which is like a very exaggerated, sassy video that I made. But it really had so many people and so many business owners comment, yep, that's exactly my experience of this. Like you're starting to kind of come out of your shell and share this idea with people and get excited. And there's going to be naysayers and there's going to be haters or just people who don't understand. And mm-hmm. that's okay. And it's your job as an entrepreneur to put your blinders on and take feedback where it's helpful and constructive and tune out everything else and focus on what you're building and continue that precision, that excellence, and that strive to get better and better. And eventually people will understand what you're building. But at the same time, it doesn't matter. You know, you need to be so excited about what you're building, and you cannot seek external validation as your why. It's really, you know, the love of the craft of building what you're building that is going to fuel you.
You cannot seek external validation. That's like some lifelong work for most people, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's excellent. That's excellent advice. But it's also a very nuanced thing to try to assess. You know, you mentioned keep your blinders on. Mm-hmm. Don't let too much of the outside noise in, but do let in the advice that, or the criticism or the feedback that is constructive and can be utilized.
Yeah. You're building for your community, right? And your product is not going to be for everyone. And the sooner you realize that, the more free you will be to create for your consumer, your community, your target audience. And you can't be everything to everyone, because you'll just end up being nothing. And as soon as you realize that you're not going to create a product for your haters, you're not here to create a product for the naysayers, you're here to create a product that provides a better life, product, service, et cetera, for your community. And they're the ones that you should be chatting with, getting their feedback, working together with, not the people who just don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Forget them.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get into Whole Foods. Yeah. Incredible.
Insane.
Yeah. Can you take me into that moment when you and Nikki found out?
We were in shock. We couldn't believe it. And at the same time, we could, which I know sounds crazy. I'm like, you know, we worked so hard. We got into Whole Foods after 4 years of pitching, and we had pitched different product lines. And you know you have the right product line if you get an immediate response within 3 hours of an email. And I think it goes to show you that success isn't linear, and that sometimes it takes a little bit of iteration of going out to market, getting feedback, going back to the drawing board. And so it wasn't an overnight success for us, because we have been doing this for almost 5 years when we got the guess. And so it was a culmination of all the insights, all the hustle, all the learnings, and the humility to keep going back again and again, and to find the right product, right time to pitch Whole Foods. And so, yes, we were shocked and excited, but it's also this immediate sense of, yeah, we deserve this too. We worked so hard to bring this really innovative product to market. And even when we got the yes, the journey to actually get onto shelves was also bumpy and not linear. But that goes to show you that behind the scenes, there's always chaos from this shiny, you know, announcement on the outside. But that goes to, again, why we like to share the behind the scenes, because it makes it more accessible for more entrepreneurs to see, okay, they went through all that and they still are achieving XYZ, so can I.
Totally. To that end, you get into Whole Foods, but you don't launch for a full year.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, it was not linear and there were some bumps along the way. I mean, this is like the juicy stuff for this show. So can you fill us in on what happened?
Yeah. So just for a little bit of context, so Whole Foods and a lot of retailers, they work a year out. So they'll start reviewing brands for a reset in the category for the next season, which is the next year prior. So there's already that time constraint of about 6 to 9 months up to a year for you to get onto shelves. But on top of that, we were delayed unexpectedly because Whole Foods' distribution partner, UNFI, suddenly, randomly, no one could have predicted this, they had a cyber attack the month that we were supposed to launch. And so if you can imagine, you shipped all of your products there on time, you've been doing all the paperwork, getting all the onboarding across the line, hustling with all these crazy deadlines that they give you, and we're ready to go, and 2 days before we're supposed to launch, we get an email from our buyer saying, hey, we're going to have to push this back. And it's devastating because we prepared all the PR. Mm-hmm. We got our website ready, our emails, our social, everything. We were about to announce this really exciting milestone. And we had to immediately go to everyone, like, turn it off. Like, don't put this, like, and it just pull everything back. And at this point, Nikki and I have gone through so many obstacles that it was upsetting. It was frustrating. But then we were over it after an hour. And that shows the resilience that we've built as operators, that things are going to go wrong. Things are not going to go as planned. How you respond to them defines you as a leader. And so we immediately shut off all of our PR, all the marketing, and said, okay, we'll just wait till the next month and we'll launch there. Then we got delayed again. And we just kept our spirits high. We focused on our other retail partners, focused on our website, focused on other parts of the business were very busy. And when it was time, we launched. And I think if you just focus on the negatives, it slows you down, it mentally exhausts you, and it pulls you away from other wins and exciting parts of the business. At that same time, we were rapidly growing in Costco. And so we're like, you know what? This is actually a silver lining. Now we can focus all of our attention to Costco. When Whole Foods is ready, we'll come in and jump. And it's really just a reframe and a pivot of how you approach obstacles that I think makes you a stronger, better operator.
And what is the mindset through which you look at obstacles?
It depends on what the obstacle is. But at the end of the day, everything works itself out is the way I think about it. And everything happens for a reason, which I know sounds cheesy, but there's always that hindsight bias where you look back and you're like, you know what? I'm really glad we made this decision, or I'm really glad we decided not to launch in all Whole Foods locations across the country. Because fun fact, we actually got approved by the global buyer to launch nationally in all stores across the country. And we said no. A lot of people, including our investors, were kind of upset about that. They're like, why would you say no to national? Why didn't you just go for the big fish? Why are you just wanting to focus on your local region of SoCal? And for some reason, we just had this foresight of, you know, Whole Foods is a big deal. We don't want to mess it up. Let's start in our backyard, nurture it. And then when we're ready, 6 months, 9 months down the line, then we'll do national. Imagine dealing with a cyber attack delay on a national level. It would have been the worst thing in the world. But because it just happened to one region, we're like, eh, we'll wait a couple months, no big deal. And so everything does work out the way it should. And at the end of the day, you can figure everything out. I think that's always been our North Star, is we have the tools, the capacity, the expertise to figure anything out in front of us. And I think every entrepreneur has that mindset, will be able to figure out whatever problem is in front of them.
And so, yeah, it's possible that you come into being an entrepreneur and a founder and you've had enough life experience that resilience is already built up. Mm-hmm. Or if not, then there's a bit of this like baptism by fire thing that I think goes on, right? Where I think there's something interesting on a personal level to be able to have those moments of reflection where you're like, you know what? I would have freaked out for a lot longer about this a year ago, you know? And then that period of time until you're back in a state of being okay and into a solution-oriented mindset gets like smaller and smaller and smaller, you know?
A perfect example is like going to the gym. Like your first workout, you're going to be sore. You're going to hate it. It's going to feel uncomfortable. You are questioning why you're even doing this. But when you go repeatedly, when you build the muscle, when you build the habit, then going to the gym feels like something you can accomplish every time you go. And I think it's just flexing that muscle of resiliency and repeating and reminding to yourself that you could handle whatever is in front of you because you historically have, then it allows you to have that lens to keep going.
Absolutely. You also had the foresight to not do a nationwide launch, which is pretty antithetical to some of the modes of thinking that like growth over everything, right? That's the North Star. Yeah. If that isn't your North Star, then what is?
Building a world-class brand that is sustainable, that has the ability to truly help our consumers. And when you think about sustainability is when you scale and grow, how do you keep the integrity of the brand, of the product, of the ingredients? And when you try to adopt a model of build things really fast and break things along the way, when you're dealing with food and when you're dealing with people, you have to be hyper-conscious of that. And for us, we want to do things right. So if that means taking a step back to do something right the first time versus breaking things at all costs and then having to clean up a mess later, we'd rather go this smart approach. Now, we've grown rapidly doing that. It's just making sure you're putting your chess pieces in the right place, thinking through, but also having that lens of, let's take a little risk here. Let's see what happens. Let's push ourselves. But also doing it with that balance of, okay, what makes sense for the business right now versus what is everyone else doing? And I think being true to what feels right for you and your brand and your company is ultimately how we like to run things.
As you've grown, are there new systems that you've put into place, essential systems that have allowed you to scale?
Yeah, in terms of how we like to keep things moving in a very lean, efficient way, but at the same time grow with scale, we take a huge partner culture to identify what are we strong at and what are we not. Mm. And that's from an individual level. So I know my strengths, my co-founder knows her strengths, and each person we hire, we try to get them to identify what their strengths are. And on the flip side, what are the weaknesses and how do we solve for that? Is it bringing in tools? Is it bringing in infrastructure? Is it bringing in another hire? Because when you're focusing on what you're really good at, when you're in your flow state, when it's just more efficient, it allows you to scale a lot more faster. Right now, we're at a really interesting time with AI, with, you know, freelance, with agencies, fractional work. And so I feel like you can do a lot more with a lot less. Right now is the best time to start a business, I believe. But at the same time, it's the hardest to stay in business. So you really have to get creative, smart, tactical, and know your numbers. And I think for us, we are so disciplined, and that's how we drive everything is this precision and laser focus on everything.
You think it's the best time to start a business?
I think it's the easiest time to start a business because you have so many resources at your fingertips, like Shopify, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, you can build a website rapidly and start getting money rapidly and fund your business. I would say it's extremely hard to stay in business at the same time. And I think you need to have the right product, the right marketing channels, you know, the right differentiation and the right discipline to execute, to continue the growth. But yeah, I would say it's never been easier to start a business.
Are you utilizing AI in your pitches?
I use AI in terms of giving me ideas or concepts, or we'll kind of brainstorm a little bit, but I'll never let AI write my emails because I can tell with like the long dashes or just the style, if it sounds robotic, I prefer to have it in my words. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if it's kind of like brainstorming concepts, I'll leverage that. Or if I want to kind of riff back and forth on an idea, I'll do that.
Before Whole Foods, mm-hmm. you were in Costco and continue to be in Costco. Mm-hmm. And you and your partner, Nikki, embarked on this North America-wide roadshow where you were essentially going to Costco's and having people sample your product and getting feedback right on site. This was the first time that you'd done something of this variety, right? Where you were like in real life with mm-hmm. people versus getting quant data online. What did that surface for you?
It was actually in California that we did the roadshow. And, you know, when we launched the company, we launched it in 2020. So we didn't have access to sample people in real life. We couldn't see the reactions in real time of them trying our product. And so we had no way of truly validating our products. And I think that's so important, especially when you're a food or beverage company. And so a roadshow was this crazy opportunity for us to sample our products in a Costco in front of 70,000 consumers who are going past our booth. And we got to test our product, our flavors, our packaging. We got to see the real-time responses, chat with them, dig deeper into what their experience was like, what they would like to see. And that data was so powerful. When you think about consumer research, people pay for that. And the fact that we as an emerging brand were able to harness that data was so powerful. We were doing brainstorm sessions in the evenings where we would recap what we learned and what ideas we got for our packaging. And that was the impetus behind our brand redesign and redesigning all of our packaging because we got so many insights of where we were missing the mark, of where consumers were confused, where people were struggling with pronouncing certain things. And it was just a perfect opportunity for us to take all the feedback, all the data that we got in real time, take it to a brand agency and develop packaging that was actually designed for retail because our prior packaging was designed for online. Mm. And you have to understand how to merge the two because something with a white screen or something with a white background behind it is going to perform totally different than something sitting in a crowded shelf with lighting and shadows and, you know, a bunch of other brands sitting right next to it. And so the roadshow informed the data insights that we needed for creating what we see today. And we could not be more grateful for that opportunity.
What was the wisdom that you were following prior in terms of your brand packaging and what's the wisdom that you're following now?
Candidly, we didn't really have wisdom in our first and we were just kind of like, this looks good. Like, why not? It was just very much haphazard designing it. We were looking to other brands for inspiration. We're like, oh, we want to be sleek and sexy like Equinox, or we wanted to look like this. We didn't really have the opportunity to really work on our ethos, our mission, because we didn't really know who we were creating for, because we thought our consumer was X person. And when we're in the field, we're actually resonating with Y person. And it wasn't until we saw that firsthand for us to be like, oh, wow, we totally need to pivot everything. And when that data is so palpable, it allows you to make these really massive decisions with ease. And so the wisdom that we now have is backed by data, both qualitative and quantitative, in terms of what resonates and what is going to allow us to reach more people more effectively.
And what is that? Because I understand you're breaking some rules.
Yeah. I mean, we saw the gap in the white space in the market is that women, especially in the protein category, are being advertised to by these protein, hyper-masculine companies that don't really understand them. And there's companies that are trying to sell them on weight loss or shrinking themselves or, you know, bulking up at the gym. And we as women, especially as fitness trainers, know that that's not the narrative that should be directed towards women. It should be encouraging them to eat protein and fiber and nourish their bodies, because a lot of them are moms. They want to feel empowered and strong and have energy throughout their days. Protein is also essential for your metabolism, for your hair, skin, and nails. It also helps with satiety, with your hormone balance. And we felt that that conversation wasn't being weaved in to the food system, especially when it comes to protein snacks. And who better than women who understand the importance of nutrition firsthand to really drive that narrative. And so that's where we wanted to really break the mold and be a different player and stand out and cater to her, as she has been historically underserved in the food system, in food marketing. And yeah, we're really excited to really break that.
How does that manifest itself? It sounds like it manifests itself partly in the packaging, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you made some bold decisions, right? To like put the picture of the product itself front and center. Mm-hmm. Can you take us through like some of the sort of unconventional decisions that you made vis-a-vis the packaging that have paid off for you?
Yeah, we wanted to break the rules of brand packaging. And a good inspiration point for us was RX Bar. One of them is also an investor. And they were revolutionary in that they put the ingredients on the front of the packaging, right? And we took some inspiration from that, and instead of prioritizing our logo or our brand name, which is the conventional rule for brand packaging, we decided, let's put the product front and center, because people have 0.2 seconds to look at something. They make snap decisions, and we wanted the product to be at the forefront. And so when you look at our product, you see protein brownie in front, you see the product in front, and that's the main thing. And then our logo and our brand name is secondary. And we made this very bold decision on a gamble, because we had this hunch that people are just want to know exactly what they're buying. And I think people are just frustrated by being marketed to, and they're like, well, what am I buying? I just want to know what this is. And I love and resonate with the concept of KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And that resonated with our packaging of, let's just be very upfront with what we're selling. They'll figure out our name later. And it actually crushed.
Amazing. Right. And it makes sense, right? Because you do sort of exist in this sort of hybrid zone where you are fundamentally a protein product, but it's not coming in the form of what we would traditionally think of as a protein bar. And so like, if you're perusing the protein bar shelves and then you see a brownie, oh my God, this is like a moment of real joy.
Yeah.
To think that the two could be commingled somehow, you know?
And imagine you hate protein bars. You find them chalky or disgusting, or you've been burned by a lot of protein bars and you're like, but I still want protein. I know I need more protein in my diet. I'm also trying to cut sugar. And then you come across this protein brownie that hits everything. It has the macros you're looking for. It also has fiber, which you know you should be eating. Did you know that over 95% of people are not getting enough fiber? And the fact that it comes in a really fun, delicious form factor of a brownie while also filling your nutritional gaps is such a win. And when you flip to the back and you see the ingredients are extremely clean and the integrity of the product is made with such intention, it's a no-brainer. And that's what we're really excited to be bringing into market, is this hybrid between a dessert that you could feel good about, that you can enjoy as your sweet treat of the day, but also this function of getting a protein snack into the day so that you feel like, okay, one check off the list. I feel good about what I'm eating.
And removing the guilt.
Exactly.
How nice.
Yeah.
We're amid this insane protein craze right now.
Yeah.
I would imagine you've seen a lift in your business as a result. Has it impacted the way that you're functioning, your marketing tactics, or were you just sort of right place, right time?
It's a combination of both. So everyone's really excited about protein, but protein has always been popular. So even before this explosion, we always knew consumers want protein. I would go to the aisles of all these different retail stores and ask people, why are you buying this product? What are you looking for? And they would always say protein. So it's not going away. I would just say that there's more of an impassioned lens around it. But it's also, I think about for our marketing is how do you, yes, and. So yes, we have protein and we have fiber and we don't use sugar alcohols. And it's really differentiating yourself in a sea of protein, proteinification, proteinified kind of food product, because consumers aren't dumb and they want to feel empowered in their purchasing decision. They want to feel proud of what they are buying for themselves and their families. And when you can differentiate with products that check all the boxes for them, it's a no-brainer. And then in regards to how we like to market, as I mentioned, I want to market to the female consumer, right? I like to say, like, this is not your boyfriend's protein bar. This is not...
Hands off.
Exactly. And it's like kind of this polarity that I like to play with. I'm like, this is not for everyone. If you're wanting something that's super cheap, we're not for you. And I think consumers are looking for a brand with personality that isn't trying to be everything for everyone, because then there's a heart and a soul to it.
Given that you're in both Costco and Whole Foods, do you have any advice in terms of working with different retailers and sort of the daylight that might exist between them? It sounds, you know, it's like relationships, right?
My best piece of advice for your retail strategy is to go to as many stores as you can. Walk the aisles. Understand your competitive set, understand your potential secondary set, talk to the employees, ask them what are the top selling products, look at the aisle, look at the top selling flavors, see what's moving, see what's not. And when you get that in-field experience, then you are arming yourself with so much data that when you're speaking to a buyer or just anyone, you know what you're talking about. I think so many people try to just make assumptions or kind of go off of data. But when you're in the aisles, you get so much more qualitative and quantitative information. And that is how you should think through that first foundation before you go into that retailer. Look at the price. Look at what's the most expensive item and what's the least expensive item. And then work backwards. Can your product fit in that pricing architecture? And then if you have your product, put it on the shelves. Take a step back. See how it looks. It's all these little things that add up that allow you to make iterations and make sure that when you do finally pitch, you're feeling as ready as you possibly can.
I feel like you've done so much really great work around pointing out how some of these seemingly minute details can have such a profound impact on your sales. Mm-hmm. And you had something really interesting around merchandising too, mm-hmm. right? Like once you are in a retailer, going mm-hmm. into the store and taking a look at how it looks on the shelf, yeah. right?
Yeah. I mean, we flew to Florida before we launched in Costco, Florida. We brought out tape measures. We measured every single one of our competitors so that we knew our box size was perfectly in line with what was already in the set, what was compliant. And we took photos of every single product so that we can look at their colors. We could look at their pack size. We looked at, you know, who was running low and how was that being in stock. And so merchandising is one of the single biggest drivers for your sales. And it could also be your biggest killer for sales. If you're not merchandised, if your product is not out on shelves, if it's not looking cute, then you are missing out on easy sales. And it's so important because if you're not visible, you can't be bought. And I think that is a huge, huge thing that brands spend thousands of dollars on to make sure, because it's so important.
I think there's just like a really big macro lesson here around just like persistence and tenacity and not making assumptions. And I think there's something that comes up in so many conversations, which is like so much of our world is so digital and we have all these incredible tools now mm-hmm. that are creating the space for us to be able to start and build businesses more easily than ever before, as you mentioned. But there's like still nothing that can replace pounding the pavement and being out in real life with people. We hear this all the time, no matter what the industry is. If you're trying to find a supplier or a manufacturer, you got to go look at the merchandising, right?
100%. You have to put in the work. And I think that often gets lost with online businesses. You assume, okay, I could just put this online and it'll sell. Okay, maybe, but are you understanding your consumer? Are you asking them for feedback? And I think when you put in that extra step, and I think it's just, there's a difference between good and great. And I always come back to that of like, a good business does okay, but a great business, an exceptional business, they go above and beyond. They do what their competitors would never even think of doing. We have like flown to Florida and Georgia and spent weekends nurturing our Costco demos to the point where people are asking us, are you marketing girls? They couldn't believe that we are the operators or the owners. And, you know, doing what most people won't do gives you that edge because you get access to information, to people, and you just put your face in front of more people. Statistically, you are setting yourself up for more success the more you put yourself out there, the more you put yourself in the field, the more you put yourself in the room. Even a 5-second buyer conversation. We flew to meet with a very big retailer, and I spent probably 4 hours in flight and commute for a 20-minute meeting. But it's so worth it to have the in-person, pounding the pavement expertise that you can only get from doing all this extra work outside of the online.
And there's something to be said, too, for the long-term nature of this as well. You never know how things will pan out.
100%.
That meeting that you thought was a failure, that person might think of you 6 months later and want to connect you with somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, these things often have ways of showing up with silver linings and blessings down the road. You know?
And that's all the more reason to build your online profile and to continue nurturing that social community. I have friends that I've known since high school that are connecting me to massive coffee shops that I would never have the opportunity to get in front of because they happen to move to that job and they are still following our content online. They're like, hey, love seeing you grow. I'm so proud of you. This is so exciting. I can connect you with this person. Do you want an intro? And it's all because we stayed very disciplined in showing people the story so they feel connected. They want to help. They want to be a part of the growth. And so it all goes hand in hand in building that ecosystem that ultimately nurtures the business.
You launched in Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. You came out with a new product.
Yep.
You're Blondie. Mm-hmm. Also in the last month.
All at the same time, yeah.
How are you keeping your head on straight?
It's very difficult. I would say for me personally, I think for any entrepreneur, you have to have what grounds you and you have to be disciplined about having that to be your anchor point. So in the mornings, without compromise, I go for a morning walk with my dog. I try not to look at my phone first thing in the morning. My co-founder and I still teach fitness classes, believe it or not. And that gives us this dedicated time to step away from the business, not look at our screens, connect back to our why, and try, air quotes, try to sleep because it's so important when you think about your time and the way that your brain is so important for the business, it really just changes everything that you can't just keep burning yourself out. You can't try to do everything. And I would say the biggest thing that I'm working on right now as a leader is how can I delegate? Because it's just simply impossible to do everything. And as a founder, you're used to doing everything. But as you level up and go more into the CEO role, you have to delegate. You have to take things off your plate so that you can perform better in what you can do. And so that's been how I've been trying to navigate the exciting growth is what can I take off my plate and how can I have someone else manage this so that I can focus on what really moves the needle.
Being willing to loosen the reins.
It's hard. It's a journey. It's a journey.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to have you back in a year and you can talk about that transition.
Yeah.
Okay. So now to wrap us up, looking back to the beginning, your first 6 months since you launched, what was one or the single most impactful thing that you did during that time that led to your success?
For our first 6 months of launch, I would say what moved the needle the most is sharing screenshots of reviews, which sounds so weird. But we weren't on, you know, a bunch of other platforms. We weren't on Amazon. We weren't on anywhere else. And so when people want to buy a product, they want to know, is it good? Am I going to like this? Does this taste good? Right? Very simple things. And so anytime we'd gift out product to friends and family, or they would just buy it out of the kindness of their hearts, we were like baby. We would screenshot the reviews and post it on our Instagram stories. And I made Nikki also reposted, and she doesn't like going on social media as much as I do, but I made us do it. And I said, the second this stops working, we will stop posting on social media. We will stop posting reviews. We will stop posting, you know, behind the scenes content, and we haven't stopped. And so I would say just sharing testimonials, whether it's a screenshot of a review or a text message or someone kind enough to make a video, share that, because people need validation. People look at what other people are saying to drive that purchasing decision. I mean, you look at Yelp, you look at Sephora, you look at all these massive retailers, they share reviews for a reason. People want to see that buy-in. So I would say, yeah, like as soon as you start to get testimonials, post them, share them, don't hide them, because that'll help other people get excited about buying your products.
Excellent conversation. So chock full of really useful advice. Thank you for being here. Thank you for this conversation, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. It was super fun.
Drop us a comment below and make sure you subscribe so you never miss new interviews. We'll see you next time.